Welcome to the Free Range Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Livermore. Today is a special bonus episode, kind of an unexpected extension of season two. As you'll hear, it's also a bit of an unusual format for the podcast. Rather than the typical interview, it's more of an impromptu roundtable discussion that came out of a working group that I was part of at the Santa Fe Institute this February. As a bit of background, the Santa Fe Institute is an interdisciplinary research institute that's dedicated to the study of complex adaptive systems. It was founded in the mid-1980s by a group of scientists, most of whom were associated with the Los Alamos National Laboratory. The idea was that complex systems are an object of study that kind of radically transcends disciplinary boundaries. So SFI was set up to facilitate crosstalk and collaboration across a really wide range of fields, from physics to biology, all the way over to economics. Now today, interdisciplinary research is all the rage, or at least people like to talk about interdisciplinary research, but 40 years ago, this was really a big innovation. SFI is also very different from a typical academic institution. It's more of a gathering place and a network, more than a traditional department or a lab. They have a big group of associated researchers who have home institutions elsewhere, but who regularly interact with the institute and with each other. And SFI hosts a ton of gatherings at different scales. These can include public conferences that are, bigger to small working groups that's just, a handful of people. And there are tons of really cool, interesting, and fancy people who are associated with SFI, including, for example, the physicist Sean Carroll, who hosts the amazing Mindscape podcast that I highly recommend, and the AI expert Melanie Mitchell. So I've been fortunate, I've had the chance to work with SFI a bit in the past. On Free Range, on this podcast, we focus on environmental issues and sustainability issues. But a part of my work is about using new tools from AI, from data science, and from text analysis to study the law and legal institutions. I'm a law scholar, so that's what I'm interested in. I am interested in using these tools. So in that line of research, I've worked a lot with someone named Dan Rockmore, who's a mathematician and computer scientist who's also affiliated with SFI. So a few years ago, we organized a working group together that was held there on computational text analysis and the law, and SFI Press published a book that Dan and I edited together that's called Law as Data, Computation, Text, and the Future of Legal Analysis. Okay, so in any case, I was at SFI again recently for a working group on an entirely different topic. This time we were talking about biodiversity and conservation, so topics that are a little bit closer to the heart of the theme of this podcast. So this working group was organized by two SFI-affiliated scholars, Andy Dobson, who's a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Princeton, and Monique Borgeroff-Mulder, who is an evolutionary anthropologist and is associated with the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. So Andy and Monique pulled together scholars from a wide range of backgrounds, social and behavioral scientists, conservation biology, ecology, law, also including folks with practical experience in advocacy and conservation. And the idea of the working group was for this small group of people to get together and focus on a paper and a project on biodiversity and the UN Sustainable Development Goals. So we spent 4 days together at SFI thinking about that and working on a paper together, basically. After our last day and before our final dinner together, a few of us, not the whole group, but a few of us got together to record a conversation about the project and the collaboration that we were working on together. So for this, in addition to Andy, Monique, and me, we have Liam Smith, who's an expert in behavioral change and the director of Behavior Works Australia at Monash University in, naturally, Australia. We have Tim O'Brien, who's an ecologist who worked for decades at the Wildlife Conservation Society. Margaret Kinnaird, who is an ecologist and the global wildlife practice leader at the World Wildlife Fund for Nature International. So she oversees like a huge portfolio of different things that are happening there. Matt Turner, a postdoc who is an expert on computational modeling and who's currently at the Stanford School of Sustainability. And Tim Caro, who is an evolutionary ecologist at the University of Bristol. It was just really an amazing group, and it was a pleasure working with these fascinating folks over the course of those days together at SFI in Santa Fe in New Mexico. And I hope that the conversation that we recorded gives a feel for the fun of these kinds of collaborations. Okay, with that intro, let's dive in. Well, this November, several of us received invitations from Monique and Andy, inviting us to this, you know, what I found to be, you know, kind of interesting and intriguing workshop. And some sufficient critical mass of people said yes to the invitations. Maybe everyone said yes to the invitations. And one question that folks might ask is, you know, why undertake all this travel, get yourself to Santa Fe? What did you see as the potential value of embarking on this enterprise? Liam, maybe you could get us started.
Yeah, sure. I guess I got the email late last year and I read it and I hadn't actually even met Monique. She'd seen me present at the conference earlier in the year and sort of liked the themes of what I was saying, which is around how a discipline could potentially be used for bigger change. And so I read the invitation. I thought, this sounds interesting. And I had other reasons to come to the US. And so I thought, yeah, I think I'll do that. And even despite not knowing Monique or indeed anyone else who was coming, it was kind of a bit of a stab. But there was an educated stab because I spoke to a few colleagues and they'd heard of the Santa Fe Institute. And they said, this is a place where you go and good stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And I tried to investigate a little bit more about how that happens. And they were very vague and said it's kind of organic and things happen. And so it intrigued me. And I like the fact of I like doing disciplinary work. I like doing work with other people from who I don't know and I can learn from. So yeah, they were probably the key reasons.
Great, yeah, it's really fun. So so Liam came from Australia, fairly far away. Tim, you came from Nairobi, also fairly far away. What was your thinking when you said yes?
Well, I actually didn't say yes. Actually, Margaret got the invitation, and Andy asked if I would tag along. Uh-huh. So,
and you, they both bring huge, valuable experience and insights into what's going on in multiple places around the world where they've worked about biodiversity and the problems associated with saving it and getting people to appreciate it.
Well, then we'll just go right to Margaret. So, why did you say yes to the invitation?
Well, in my role at WWF currently as the Global Wildlife Practice Lead, I am asked to think about delivery against the SDGs and the Convention on Biodiversity targets every day. So I go to bed and I wake up thinking about how I'm going to deal with this. And I get this incredible invitation from Andy saying, you have the opportunity to come to the Santa Fe Institute, which, like Liam, I had heard about as, wow, what a cool place to go to and think about these things.
We might even meet David Byrne.
Yeah. But also with people that think about behavior change and economists and other ecologists. And it just seemed like a really incredible opportunity to be with people who were thinking in different dimensions about how we overcome some of these impediments to delivery against what's going to keep us alive
right.
In the future.
Yeah. Well, speaking of those alternative perspectives, Matt, you got an invitation, quite different from, you know, some of the other folks who have talked so far. So how did that invitation land on your inbox, and why did you end up saying yes?
Well, it landed in my inbox, I guess, through a recommendation from my PhD advisor, Paul Smaldino, who taught me everything I know about applying agent-based models to all sorts of problems in behavior and behavior change and why do people behave the way they do. And Santa Fe has always been a mecca of science to me. And I was trained as a physicist too, and lots of amazing physics work has been done here. And as a postdoc in the sustainability school at Stanford, I I try to take my computer nerd skills and apply them to problems that really matter. And this just struck me as an opportunity to do that and learn from some amazing researchers who I didn't know. I also hadn't met anybody prior to coming here, but I just knew that Santa Fe Institute is a place where excellent scientists go to do high impact work. And I am so honored to be a part of it.
Yeah. Tim, did you get an email?
Yeah, I got an email. And the reason that I said yes...
Almost as many as you wrote.
The reason that I said yes was really because I taught conservation biology for about 20 years. I'm trained as an ecologist. And I felt I'd kind of taken that as far as I could, because I think that saving the biodiversity on this planet is actually in the hands of people rather than in the hands of... conservation biology theory, and I wanted to start to interact with other academics who know about people's behavior, economists who know about people's behavior, and I saw it as an opportunity to really touch base with people I never normally talk to. I normally talk to biologists. Here was a chance to talk to people who are going to stimulate me and think about new directions.
Yeah, great. Well, it's been wonderful past several days. And one of the interesting dynamics that emerged relatively early in our conversations is we broke into kind of two broad groups, right? One was on these impediments to achieving biodiversity goals and integrating biodiversity into decision making. And a second was a modeling group. So actually our two organizers kind of, you know, broke into those two groups. So maybe we could hear a word about why you think, you know, that we ended up, say, for example, Monique, on the thinking about these impediments. I mean, we came in with like a broad charge, which is think about these issues. And we ended up pretty focused on this question of impediments to integration of biodiversity into decision-making. Why do you think we kind of landed on that?
I'm happy to answer that question. At some stage, I want you to answer why you said yes to the invitation. But we'll put that aside for the moment. Yeah, we started with somewhat different views. And remember, we gave you all homework about ranking the SDGs that you thought were most important to help achieve SDG 15, which is life on Earth or life on the planet.
Life on land.
Life on land. Thank you very much. You can see I've already forgotten it. We had some interesting discussions about how the SDGs were interrelated. Mm-hmm. And we realized that there are probably 1,000 causal diagrams underlying their connections, and that we'd never be able to solve them, at least with empirical data, during the, you know, the four precious days we have here. So we focused more on thinking about decision making and well, more centrally integrating considerations of biodiversity into decision making. And once we had that question, I don't really know who it came from. It was probably one of these things. Maybe it came from you.
Maybe.
Oh,
but all of us, we all kind of voted.
Yeah, absolutely.
You looked at the list of voting. It was one that the social scientists and the ecologists said, this is something really new.
Right. Well, we all went on 16, and then we realized we need institutions. And if you need institutions, what are institutions really? They're formalized ways of making decisions. So we all settled there very comfortably. And then I think you, Maggie, sort of brought us more to the 14. CBD, is that correct? These numbers are confusing. And so then we had a format. And after that, I mean, that was sort of by the evening of the second day, we were on a roll. We knew exactly what we were doing. And those of us not in the modeling group, well, I don't know. Maybe we did. I thought we did. Those of us not in the modeling group were thinking pretty clearly about the impediments. Mm-hmm. Then we got into how to structure them and examples. But let me hand over to the unbelievably clever modelers.
No, I mean, the modeling is if that. The modeling rose out of two things. One, to me, one of the most marvelous moments of the meeting was when Joe Ogutu, who, you know, entirely by himself over the last 10 to 20 years, has assembled a complete history of what's gone on in Kenya which is a beacon for sort of conservation success, that has lost 90% of its biodiversity. Mm. And Joe has assembled all this information and showed us a sort of pressy of it on Monday. And it was like, well, whatever we do, we have to have a real world example. So let's tie it back into that. Mm-hmm. And of course, once you have a real world example, you've got to spoil it by having a mathematical model. But that's also, as we've all joked about it, but as you walk into the door of the Santa Fe Institute, it says, if you don't know geometry, don't come in.
Right.
And which essentially now means that if you don't know mathematics, don't come in. So I felt it would be important to have tools to dissect the type of data that Joe's collected that might then generalize and be applicable to other ecosystems, which have, every one of which has this problem that people don't value biodiversity enough, and how do they integrate it into the business decisions they make about those places?
Right. Yeah.
So Andy, can I just jump in here? Yeah. Just explain to us why modeling is important in this particular context.
Just putting on my total Santa Fe Institute hat, if you can't write it down as mathematical equations, you don't understand. Once you've got it like that, we can do this thing of saying, we can do these alternative scenarios. What happened if we hadn't done this at a certain time? What would it look like? What happens if we change the management and do this? It gives you a mechanism of doing things that go forward 20 or 30, 40 years in a computer that you, or just as a set of equations, that you can never afford to do all those replicates in the real world. So it gives you a chance to try and understand the system in a way you can manipulate it to really understand what happens to that system as people change their value judgment on how important biodiversity is to them.
Yeah.
A playpen.
A playpen. Yeah, it's the happy, you know, equations of the playpen for deep, happy nerds.
Well, you know, kind of maybe moving from that, the abstract realm of geometry and mathematics to...
Will you answer my question?
Oh, sure. I can answer the question. So why did I say it? So Andy and I met each other at a different kind of interdisciplinary workshop in France, where I happened to be staying for the year. And my talk at that was completely unrelated to anything that had to do with the environment. I was talking about AI and law, which is another kind of thing that I work on. But at some point, Andy and I just were chatting, I think, and maybe you mentioned you were thinking about some of these things, and I mentioned my other work in the environmental domain, and then I got an email a couple months later, and I had been done some work with the SFI in the past, and I actually co-organized a working group, and I knew about how wonderful the environment is here for, you know, really just interesting thinking. And so, I mean, if you get an invitation to the SFI, you basically say yes, unless there's a really good reason not to.
And the obverse of that is, I mean, I think Monique and I both did this. We sort of said, you know, we've got to make something happen in those 4 days. Who were people you've seen over the last couple of years that don't know each other, that if you got them together, would produce something super interesting? Can you identify smart people and give them a big challenge and say, can you give us help with this? And that, you know, that applies to everybody in the room.
Maybe we should take this moment to say that Joel Berger is very much a contributor to this as well. He and Tim and Andy have been discussing these issues on or related issues on email for a long time. Mm-hmm. I sometimes hear the expletives, but I was never involved, but I have become involved now.
You had a thesaurus for some of those words.
You need it, well, right. But Joel is not here, but we very much miss him because he's a phenomenal biologist, wildlife biologist, who would have brought incredible additional vision, and we miss him dearly, but I know he's chasing, what is it, something in Vietnam?
Small ungulates, but we're not quite sure whether he'll find any of them.
If a Sao La, he won't.
He won't.
The mythical Sao La, yes.
And there are other people who we hope to have remotely, but, you know, we're so far to the western part of the world that most of them have already gone to bed before we even get up. So.
Right. Now, coordinating, coordinating a conference in a 24-hour world is difficult. I mean, one of my understanding on this email chain is that one of the kind of background realities is this, you know, just the frank crisis that we're facing on biodiversity. So I wonder if we can maybe just say a few motivating words. It's kind of the overhang for the whole conversation here is just this reality and the urgency that kind of exists. And so maybe it's worth just mentioning that, and then also, you know, kind of how work like this relates to kind of that real world problem.
Well, if you look at all the measures of what's happening in our world today, things like the Living Planet Index, it shows that we've lost, what is it, 70% of the species, average species populations across the globe since 1970s. I mean, and you look at the state of threatened species, and we've just increased the number of species that are listed as threatened with extinction under IUCN. I mean, it goes on and on. You hate to always be promoting the doomsday picture. However, we are in a biodiversity crisis. And we're at a point that if we don't work to bend the curve on biodiversity loss, and not only bend it, but restore biodiversity, our own well-being is at risk. I mean, look at what biodiversity does for us. It, you know, without pollinators, we're not gonna have our crops pollinated. We're not gonna have our important fruit trees dispersed. We're going to see forests that are more wind dispersed instead of dispersed by wildlife that takes the seeds of larger trees that are more carbon dense. And you know, you just see things, the tapestry of things unraveling, and it's frightening. And the world needs to wake up. And I think I'm optimistic because I feel like we're seeing corporates, we're seeing governments paying much more attention to the issue of biodiversity loss and the nexus with climate change than we ever have in the past. And we have all the science to show that what we need to do. So part of it is just getting people to pay attention and overcome some of these impediments that we were talking about all this week to move forward and reverse these trends and bring our lives back into a nature positive situation.
Right, restore some sanity. So Liam, that's part of your job, is to think about how we actually influence human beings' decisions. And so maybe you could just offer a few words of how we move from that kind of stark reality that we face and actually get decisions that are more in line with what we need.
Yeah, I think groups like this start to do that already because they bring in the soft sciences, or the HASS as they're sometimes known, with the STEM scientists together. And I think a problem like conservation requires both. I think it's been said many times that conservation is a people problem as much as it is, well, mostly it's probably a people problem more than it is another problem.
Totally.
So, and so, and it reminds me of, you know, of people back where I live who say, I've been trying to raise these issues with decision makers for 30 years. I've been telling them that this species is going extinct or that this ecosystem is collapsing, to no effect. And they're so frustrated because they know stuff that ought to be really informative. And that stuff is really important and vital. We need that evidence base to be able to draw on. But I think we also need the behavioral sciences and the economists and the lawyers and other parts of the humanities or other disciplines within the humanities to add to that base and understand things like what types of laws or regulations might help better decision making, what behavior change tools can we use to convince people to make better decisions? What incentives do we put in place that help people move from a position of inaction to action around drawing on this evidence base? So I'm a bit like Maggie, I've got hope, right? I think it's hope, but it's because of groups like this, and it's because of our ability to bring these skills together and these disciplines together in a collective effort.
Yeah, Yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, following up on that, I'm as a conservation biologist, I really understand that we have most of the science worked out as to how to conserve species, but the politicians and the decision makers are not listening to the scientists. And I've always felt that we need to bridge that gap. Somehow scientists miss the boat in that they come up with extremely good data, but they're unable to convey it to the people who really matter in terms of making the conservation decisions. Mm-hmm. And so that's the reason that I wanted to come to SFI, was to learn from people who know how to convey scientific information effectively to people who are not scientists. And I really have learned a lot in making that transition.
So I have a question. How important is this transmission this transmission of information to policymakers and trying to use behavioral science tools to influence the way they make decisions? How important is that compared to on the streets activism?
I think there's a middle ground there. I think many politicians are impossible to educate, but
yes,
they very much look at the voting numbers. So it's not so much the on the street activism. It's how do we educate the massive, the silent majority, if you like, leaping back 50 years, about the importance of biodiversity. How do you get not just the kids on the street who are doing a fabulous job, but all those big demographic bulge of people from the age of 25 to 60 to say, this is going to be vital for my kids and my grandkids. So I need to do this.
I think that's spot on, Andy. And what you find with most people will have positive attitudes and dispositions to biodiversity, to its protection, mm-hmm. to spending, exactly. to policy that protects it. This silent majority
yeah.
have those views.
Yeah.
And so I think it is a case of capturing those and then delivering them in obviously effective ways to decision makers. The other thing I'd probably add to that is around timing. I think timing is actually crucially important, particularly to political decision making. Government decision making probably has more pattern to it, but political, you've got to be agile and you've got to be ready at that moment to say, hey, you've got a new policy on biodiversity. Did you know that 97% of people want more spending on biodiversity? Yeah, and here's my evidence.
Yeah.
And be right there ready with that at that time.
Totally correct.
Right. And when you talk about timeline, this is what freaks me out. I mean, we're 6 years away from 2030 mm-hmm. when we're supposed to deliver against all of these goals. That's not very far away. The urgency is like we've never experienced before.
Yeah. And if we
can't change minds and hearts rapidly, we're in trouble.
Matt, do you want to jump in about changing minds and hearts? Because you know something about that.
But you're younger than all of us. Your mind and heart is much more important than ours.
That's the demographic bulge as you think.
Yeah, they're the ones.
I know. Yeah.
I'm going on looks.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I don't usually correct people on how young I like to be. One thing that strikes me is that these problems are so urgent, and my urge a lot of times as a scientist is, and one of the goals of modeling is to try to develop general principles of behavior change. What is it about social networks that make information spread better? But and what are some general things about groups that make it so that people don't want to listen to other groups? Mm-hmm. And what is the role of, thinking about cognitive development over a lifespan? We know that young people are a lot more prone to try new things, to protest, to be open to new ideas. And while it might sometimes feel like reductive to take all the complexity that exists in biodiverse systems, ecological systems, and social systems, and try to boil that down to just some fundamental principles, I think it's important to try to, like Andy said, make a plan, try to have some idea of how these interventions are going to spread. And I have hope that it is worthwhile to take the time to try to generalize examples like the Kenyan example, try to say, okay, here's what happened in Kenya. Here are some general principles we think are at work. What else could be going on that could be applied to other situations? And I think that gives me hope that we actually are able to do that. You know, I count myself among many other, you know, following in the footsteps of many other really smart people who have blazed that trail, and I'm trying to do the same thing. And I think too, it among scientists, there is some, like, even though I'm still the youngest one here, even though I'm not as young as I think I am. You know, I think that there is a new generation of people like me coming along who really want to work beyond, you know, disciplinary boundaries in a way that's not just for show, but for really for making a difference in the way that the world needs right now.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, to me, we have more elections going on this year than any other year.
Yeah.
Most young people are not interested because they see it as something that's doing something with old people. If we could empower young people to see that the most important things to vote on are to do with the environment of this planet, mm-hmm. and inspire them to go out and vote, that would make a huge difference.
Well, I was just going to ask you to sort of bring together this idea of, you know, biodiversity and trying to get the message across to other people who are really making decisions and young people. Could you do that?
Well, difficult. One of the, you know, thinking about the products. Thank you, Tim. Thinking about the products of this working group, one will be some sort of policy piece that we'd hope to get published in a high profile journal. But to be honest, there have been a lot of discussions amongst the younger and more media responsive kind of members of our group who've got some really exciting new ideas about trying to sort of gamify aspects of the environment, aspects of quantifying the dollar value of biodiversity, which is something we've been struggling with intellectually, but is, you know, if we could get that as a kind of a usable tool that either school kids could use, or university kids, students could use, or people in communities, or, you know, even maybe at the state level or something like that. I'm not going.
She would be fantastic.
She would be fantastic.
Yeah, but we might get a fight. I don't want any of that, right?
Well, I think we need a fight, to be honest.
Okay.
Yeah. No, we need that level.
Yeah. So I think there's going to be other products that mm-hmm. come out of this workshop. And actually, I'd like to note that we, when SFI advertised this working group, we had two people who we had not expected to just sort of approach us and say, hey, can we join?
Yeah.
And they both come with a lot of skills with respect to recording, you know, video and sort of interfacing with social media and looking at sort of conservation finance and things like that, which is really exciting because none of us are, well, you are, but the rest of us are not terribly good at that stuff. And so I see a huge output of this workshop, not as purely academic, but as outreach, and particularly to youth,
yes.
given the points that Andy was making.
Yeah. So maybe we're kind of low on time, so maybe the last thing we could talk about really briefly is, you know, there's a big discussion of values, and we talked a little bit about kind of economic value and so on. And so maybe, Tim, you could offer some of your thoughts on this, because you were kind of a major advocate of making sure that we did not only just focus in on kind of the economic value associated with biodiversity. So why do you think that's important to ensure that that's kind of, we're not myopically focusing in on that?
Well, one of the ecosystem services provided by biodiversity is a cultural aspect of biodiversity. So, you know, there is the spiritual aspect of just connecting with nature. There is religious aspects for many cultures who adore nature or worship nature. And then there is just the intrinsic value of having a complete ecosystem. So, you know, we had a lot of, in our discussions of ecosystem services, we focused very heavily on the economic value of biodiversity. But with the huge amount of biodiversity is extremely rare. And there's a lot of argument, or there's a lot to argue that for any particular ecosystem service, most biodiversity does not contribute. However, this large segment of very rare species do have an intrinsic value. I mean, you can't place a dollar value on it, but it matters to a lot of people, a lot of cultures, and a lot of institutions.
I mean, I think of us, you know, we've known each other as biologists for like 40 years. When, as soon as we get to each other said, we went to so-and-so. The biodiversity there was spectacular. We got a chance to see that. And that rare excitement and how you, yeah, and it's rare. And the excitement of that, it's like more people need to be able to do that. Yes. And then everybody be totally into biodiversity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what we want. In the end of the day, that's the idea is for everyone to be totally into biodiversity. Yeah. If we get that outcome, we'll be in a much better place than we are.
Yeah.
Especially governments.
No, especially young people who vote.
I mean, I see us as for younger co-travelers on planet Earth with a lot of other species, and we all have a right to be here. So we better be very careful in making sure that that occurs.
Yeah.
And it's right now, it's important to get that message across to as many people as we can, especially in biodiverse countries where the rubber really hits the road.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful message to wrap up with. I think we have a dinner coming up, so it's been wonderful for me, I'll just say, to enjoy the past 4 days
together.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it. Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, remember to subscribe or give us a review or a like. We also now have a Patreon page for listeners who are interested in supporting a new season of Free Range. If you like the podcast and would like it to continue, pop over to Patreon and search for Free Range with Mike Livermore if you want to add your support. Till next time.